Senate shakeup. Oh boy, the Mounties have their work cut out for them. And Senate leaders in the red chamber on the hook for improper expenses.
We're looking forward to making this report public. We're making forward to coming clean with the Canadian public on this issue.
Two sitting senators are among the nine cases to be sent to the RCMP for criminal investigation, one conservative and one liberal. The Auditor General has found another 21 senators filed questionable expenses that must be repaid. Among them, three of the most powerful in the Senate leadership. Tory Senate Leader Claude Carrion, Senate Speaker Leo Hosokas, and Opposition Leader James Cowan, who faces a $10,000 bill for travel to Toronto.
Well, they want more documented. What were the meetings about? Who did you meet with? This sort of thing. I simply don't have that information.
The Senate audit cost $21 million to recover just under $1 million of questionable expenses. The NDP do not have any senators in the chamber, and Leader Tom Mulcair wants to abolish the upper chamber. He joins me now from his riding office in Montreal. Mr. Mulcair, the RCMP will now be investigating two sitting senators and seven former senators. Should the Senate immediately suspend Senator Claude Beauvenu and Colin Kenney?
Well, I think that they should clearly act, at least with regard to those two, Bob. But as you know, and you said it in your introduction, the NDP for a long time has been saying, in a democracy, you don't have unelected people deciding the laws for the rest of it. It's just an anachronism. It goes back to another time. It's an imitation of the British House of Lords. We don't need it. All the Scandinavian countries have a one-chamber system, a single house making the laws for the country. That's what the NDP wants to get to for Canada. We're going to work hard on that. It is tough work, but I'm convinced that Canadians now, with what they've seen, want to get rid of the unelected and unaccountable Senate.
So the Auditor General found another 21 senators had filed questionable expenses, including three members of the top Senate leadership. What should be done about that?
Well, again, there's a basic rule of what's called natural justice, and it says that you can't be a judge in your own case. But isn't that what we've got here? I mean, Senator Hosokas, who is now the highest ranking person in the Senate, put there by Stephen Harper, has essentially rigged the rules to decide whether or not he's broken the rules, because he's put in place a system to try to get himself off the hook. He should have had nothing to do with that. He should have recused himself, but instead he's trying to get himself off the hook. I think that that's just a further proof that Canadians can't have confidence in the institution. And Stephen Harper used to talk a good game about getting rid of the Senate. He threw in the towel. You know, he just folded his arms and decided he's not going to try anymore. I've been traveling the country constantly. We've had tens of thousands of people who have signed a petition that we put online to roll up the red carpet and get rid of the Senate. And I've met with many premiers and talk about this every time. And you know what? I've yet to meet a single person in any province who's in favor of maintaining the Senate.
So if the NDP are elected and you become prime minister, you will call a first minister's conference to get rid of the Senate.
I would certainly sit down with all of the premiers. Now, I know that there are sometimes there are going to be provinces with specific demands. For example, Prince Edward Island, when I met with Premier Giz at the time, he said we want to make sure we keep the number of seats we have in the House of Commons. We've got side deals like that. I know that Quebec has particular concerns about proportion of representation in Parliament as a whole, which is the House of Commons and the Senate. But I'm convinced, again, with good faith, open approaches, we're going to be able to get to solutions that will allow us to get rid of this archaic system, which is called the Senate, and go to something positive and hopeful for the future.
Now, once the writ is dropped, we know that Senators Mike Duffy, Pamela Wall, and Patrick Brazeau, and who knows these other two senators who are now going to be part of an RCMP investigation, will be back on the payroll. So what needs to be done to get people who are under RCMP investigation from being able to collect paychecks?
Well, it's not only the fact that they can collect paychecks. I remember in the recent Nova Scotia provincial election that was won by the Liberals, there was a stage full of Liberals, including the Liberal senators from that province, who boasted and were being thanked for having done the fundraising for the Liberal Party. You see, for years, this has been a mega slush fund for the old-time parties. Conservatives and Liberals, every time it was their turn, they packed the place with their defeated candidates, their cronies, their bagmen, and then they went on to use their Senate standing to collect money and do fundraising work for the party that named them there. That was the basic reason that Pamela Wallin and Mike Duffy were named in the first place. And I think the Canadians are starting to realize that this thing has just got to be gotten rid of, full stop. I think that the very fact that they would be going back on the payroll is sufficient evidence for Canadians that it is high time that we got rid of the Senate.
Now, the Commons Board of Internal Economy has ruled that your MPs must pay back almost $3 million. Would you be open to having former Supreme Court Judge Ian Binney arbitrate, as he is doing with the Senate, rather than rely on the what you say is a biased board?
Well, actually, the term we like to use, Bob, is that it's a kangaroo court. And don't forget, every time the Senate issue arises, and I know you've got too much experience not to know what's going on, Liberals and Conservatives working together, using their majority at this totally secretive Board of Internal Economy, all of a sudden start talking about the NDP and their bogus charges against us. We've respected every rule, every step of the way. They know that. Then they tried to change the rules. We respected the new rules every step of the way. They know that. It is a kangaroo court. It is just Liberals and Conservatives trying to stop the NDP, which they see is doing quite well. And they're going to try to drag everyone down with them if they possibly can in the Senate matter. I mean, they're facing real courts with real judges and real RCMP investigations. We've taken this to a real court. And we even went so far as to write to Canada's Justice Minister, Peter McKay, and say, look, let's not waste any time with this. Refer it straight to the Supreme Court, as you're allowed to do. That's how confident we are that the NDP has respected every rule, every step of the way.
Mr. Mulcair, it's being said that the way to power on October 19th is through the cities. You spoke to the Federation of Municipalities on Saturday, and you made some big promises in terms of the gas tax and other measures to help rebuild crumbling infrastructure and improve transit.
Yes, and I've been speaking to the mayors across Canada. It's part of the work that I've been doing. And I realize that without a reliable, predictable federal partner, that it's going to become increasingly difficult. This is a statistic that might surprise a lot of people, Bob, that we expect the municipalities in our country to take care of 60% of the infrastructure with only 8% of the tax base. The math just doesn't work. So the NDP would propose to become a reliable long-term partner. We get rid of a lot of the red tape that the Conservatives have been imposing. For example, they insist that it has to be public-private partnerships. Sometimes that is the right solution, sometimes it's just the wrong one. So they have this ideological bent that it always has to be that. It's caused long delays getting the money out to the municipalities in areas like transit. We would take existing gas tax money and we would transfer it over to help with infrastructure. Again, we would add to what's already been promised and we would make sure that there would be a further $1.5 billion that would be added to that, predictable, long-term, a 20-year deal that they could rely on and know would be coming. Housing is increasingly in a crisis state. I spoke with Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson. You know that there's a bubble there in Vancouver. It's increasingly impossible for young families to hope to be able to buy a home. So these are things that the federal government can work hand in hand with the provinces and territories on. We don't want to work in their place, but we do want to work with them. And we think that that sort of reliable partnership is the way of the future.
Now, you were present for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's events in Ottawa last week. And if you were in government, would you accept all 94 recommendations put forward in that report? The Liberals say they would.
Yeah, but I also understand what it is to govern. I've sat around the cabinet table. I know what it is to have priorities. There's no subject on which I've held more meetings or spent more time since becoming leader of the opposition than those involving our First Peoples, First Nations, the Métis Nation, and Inuit people. And I know that we have to have priorities. Our number one priority is to establish a respectful nation-to-nation approach. Now, this isn't the first big Royal Commission report that we've had. Almost 20 years ago, there was the Erasmus Dussault Commission report that was phenomenal. It was great work. And it also has to be brought out of the dustbin where it's been staying for the past 20 years. It's got great recommendations. So we'll start with things that are easy to tackle. Education. Would any Canadian accept to be part of a category of persons whose children get 30% less? We've got to fix it. Mr. Harper promised to fix it in the future, but he was going to dictate the terms. Father's knows best. That's the problem that led to the residential schools. We've got to have a respectful approach where we recognize the rights of First Nations. A lot of this is going to require work with the provinces and territories. You can't just snap your fingers and decide, for example, that you're going to take care of the welfare issue and the child welfare issue, because a lot of that is provincial. And I'll tell you one thing specifically, Bob. Prime Minister's going to be meeting the Pope in the next little while. Now, the Pope has issued a formal apology from the Catholic Church for the abuses by priests in Ireland. With all the evidence that's now on the table, the Vatican should issue a formal apology for the Catholic Church's role in the residential schools. While the Prime Minister is with the Pope, he should simply ask him if he's willing to issue that sort of an apology. That's something constructive that's being asked for that we could do. We're going to sit down with First Nations. We'll prioritize. We'll get to the subjects that they consider the most important, and we'll do it in order that they consider the most important. It's not a matter of snapping your fingers and saying that you're going to do all 94 at once. That's not realistic, and it's not going to happen.
Mr. Mulcair, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
All the best, Bob. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, we've got to get back to the Senate scandal and the leaked revelations in the Auditor General's audit. Our regular criminal lawyer, Solomon Friedman, joins us, and former law clerk of the House of Commons, Rob Walsh. So, Mr. Walsh, nine more senators going to an RCMP investigation. If you were the Senate law clerk today, what would you be advising?
The Senate or these nine senators?
Well, the Senate first.
Well, the Senate has no role to play in that. It's going to the RCMP. The RCMP will do its investigation, and the Senate, obviously, my advice to the Senate would be to cooperate with the RCMP's investigation.
And if you're a criminal lawyer, there are nine people that I guess you're saying to them, you're available for work, but lawyer up fast?
Well, it sounds like this is going to be great news for criminal lawyers. You know, we thought that Mike Duffy maybe had the monopoly on that, but it looks like the wealth will be there to be spread, and hopefully generously.
Now, Robert, here's what I'm curious about, because nine will go immediately to the RCMP for investigation. There are 21 other senators who have questionable expenses. I'm told that the RCMP will, our duty bound, will to want to review those 21, even if there may be nothing of a criminal nature, just as a precaution.
Well, that's probably true. They would feel they have a professional obligation to confirm that there is nothing there of a criminal nature that warranted investigation. I mean, the AG, in recommending they go to the RCMP, is not the one to decide that question. The RCMP itself will decide whether these other cases warrant investigation or not.
So what's the effect of, you know, nine for sure criminal and another 21 questionable expenses. Does this help Duffy, who's been saying all along, hey, I'm not the only one?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question, and it's one that will only be answered once we can look at that report and figure out what type of conduct gets you in the 21 group and what type of conduct gets you in that group of nine. Because if any of Duffy's activities fall into that 21 group, that's a fairly decent defense to say, if the Auditor General, who has recommended some people to the RCMP for charges, doesn't believe that this is criminal conduct, well, surely I can't be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But if he falls into that nine category in terms of all of his conduct, that could be problematic.
Donald Bain, Mr. Duffy's lawyer, can use this report right away. I mean, he can take it as his defense document.
Yes, we've seen the Ernst & Young report, for example, was admitted as an exhibit for the truth of its contents. And I can assure you that if Don Bain thinks this document is helpful to him in any way, it'll be, you know, in front of the judge as soon as possible.
So what do you think of that?
Well, I'm not a big fan of this Donald Bain argument about everyone else was doing it, so it must be all right. But I would agree with Mr. Friedman that to the extent that the AG is saying that these 20 other 21 are, as it were, administrative errors as opposed to criminal conduct, that would likely, and if Mr. Duffy fitted into that, then to that extent it may be helpful to Mr. Duffy. But generally speaking, I don't think the argument that one can point to a set of rules as being vague and thereby get off any responsibility for what one does, I don't personally buy that argument.
The Senate leaders, the Tory Senate leader Claude Carignan, and the Speaker Hosakis, and the Liberal leader James Cowan, they are the ones who decided on having a special arbiter step in. Nobody disputes former Supreme Court Justice Ian Binney is a great choice, but they were also subject to the audit and are found to owe money. Should they have recused themselves from that?
of course they should have, in my judgment. I just find this very hard to believe. I don't know, as I've said once before, in connection with the story, I don't know whether to laugh or cry. This is rankly incompetent that these three gentlemen would move into a leadership role when, and we're told this is the case, they've been told that the AG has some reservations about their expense claims, that they should move into a leadership role and set up this regime for dealing with disputes. I mean, no. It is absolutely unbelievable that they should allow this to happen. The Senate, I've almost lived to the point now, Bob, where I think the Senate may need to be put into a trusteeship. I think the leadership doesn't know how to manage its institution, and we should appoint a trustee to look after the Senate for all its legal problems. It's just that bad.
But they wouldn't be required to resign their positions, only that they should not have involved themselves in this.
Well, they should not be part of the committee they sit on now, which made decisions about this process. Stand back and participate in the process as a senator, but not beyond that.
What's your view on that?
You know, it's a very interesting conflict of interest issue. But the real trouble here is, you know, who watches the watchman? We have the concept in Canadian law of parliamentary supremacy, and that's why we hear these discussions about parliamentary privilege. The parliament is supreme. So who then is going to govern parliament? And ordinarily, you have committees or subcommittees made up of parliamentarians themselves. But when it's those very same parliamentarians who are being investigated for wrongdoing, that presents, you know, a very clear, if at the very least, an apprehension of bias, if not actual bias itself. It's certainly a very troubling issue, and one, it appears, with no real clear answer.
And finally, what do we do about the Senate? I mean, should there be an effort to abolish it? Should there be an effort to seriously reform it? Because I don't know how we can continue on with any kind of respectability given the criminal probes hanging over it.
Well, I think this current scandal is the occasion for asking that very question, and it's a very important question. But we shouldn't respond to that question having in mind this disastrous situation in the current Senate. And I think we should look at some suggestions for how the institution could be improved and how appointments could be made in a less partisan manner. And those kinds of issues should be addressed if one believes there is a valuable constitutional function served by the Senate. If one is not of that view, then obviously one would say shut it down. But if you think there's a constitutional purpose served by the Senate, then let's go back to the drawing boards and think about how we should appoint to the Senate, and whether we should reframe those duties in some manner. But it's a legitimate question. I think it's a question that now has greater prominence and hopefully will not just fade away once this particular scandal itself fades away.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Welcome back. The Prime Minister is attending the G7 meeting in Germany today and tomorrow, but he made a side trip to Ukraine yesterday. CTV's Katie Simpson is traveling with the Prime Minister, and she joins us now from Germany. So, Katie, what was the PM's reception in Ukraine when he talked tough about Russia?
As you can imagine, Bob, Stephen Harper's words were welcomed and echoed by both Ukrainian Prime Minister and President. Harper met first with Ukraine's PM to condemn Russian aggression, but also to announce a new aid package, $5 million over the next year to help train and develop a new civilian police force. Canada was thanked for its extensive overall support, but Ottawa is being called on to do more. The Ukrainian Prime Minister wants defensive weapons for his soldiers to fend off Russian-backed rebels, and Western countries, including Canada, are being asked to provide that kind of support. Harper has previously shied away from the idea, but after a day of meeting with Ukraine's leaders, he's promising to at least bring it up at the G7. But Canada won't be going it alone on this. Harper has said that he'll only be working alongside like-minded countries on this issue. As well, Stephen Harper was asked to allow more Ukrainians into Canada. It's an issue since a number of visas, about a third of all visas coming from Ukraine, are rejected. Harper did commit to having a dialogue on that.
You're in Germany today, and what's on the agenda for the G7?
The global economy and what to do about the Greek financial crisis will be looming over world leaders, but expect many of the headlines from the summit to focus on climate change. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said she wants to make the environment a priority. Canada has been criticized ahead of the summit for not meeting emissions targets laid out by its own government, and German protesters are taking note. In the days leading up to the G7, demonstrators singled out Harper. Now, the Canadian delegation will be steering the focus toward global security, and Harper plans to repeat much of what he said in Ukraine yesterday, taking a hard line against Vladimir Putin. Bob.
Thanks, Katie. Enjoy the rest of the trip. Well, as Katie mentioned, the global economy is on the agenda in Germany. The International Monetary Fund has substantially downgraded its U.S. economic growth forecast, and the Paris-based OECD says Canada's economy will grow at only 1.5%, down sharply from 2.2%. What does this mean for the country in an election year? We'll ask our MPs. Joining me here in the studio, NDP MP Guy Caron, Liberal finance critic Scott Bryson, and Conservative Scott Armstrong. So there's mounting evidence that the global and Canadian economy are slowing down. In fact, the IMF is saying to the United States, please don't increase interest rates because it could really stall the economy. Do we need to put more stimulus in the economy other than just the tax measures that you put in the budget?
Well, I think if you look at the fundamentals of the Canadian economy, we have a balanced budget. We have the best debt to GDP ratio of any country in the G7, and we're moving in the right direction. We are going to be growing, but we do have to contend with a global economy, which is kind of precarious. So we have to make sure that we focus on Canada's economy. That's the number one priority for our government. We're going to continue to do that, but the fundamentals of Canada's economy continue to be strong.
Well, actually, not so true about that, because the GDP growth numbers have stalled, and many people expect Alberta and Newfoundland, Mr. Caron, could be in a recession later this year.
Yeah, we're in a situation right now where, I mean, the IMF is talking and we should be listening right now, but we don't see much action from this government. We see a steady as she goes action or reaction from them. Basically, we should be looking at trying to reassure. Confidence will be a key factor, and right now the Minister of Finance is missing in action. The government has been spending lots of money. We should not forget that. But on the other side, it's not really evaluating if the spending actually has been productive. If we're getting the bang for our buck, basically. Look at, for example, the measure in which over $500 million was basically given in EI premium reductions to small business, promising 20,000 jobs being created, while in fact we're nowhere close to this number. But the government is not actually looking at the results of these actions. While if we're looking at the needs right now, and something that would actually help this economy and help create this confidence would be massive or important important investments in infrastructure. The Federation of Canadian Municipalities is actually meeting right now. We know the needs in urban centers. We should be acting now.
Mr. Bryson, we know that the unemployment rate has remained on steady at almost in that 7% range for years. I know on Friday we did get the economy created surprisingly 58,000 jobs, but we're still in a situation where unemployment is staying far too high, even compared to the United States, which is now down about 5.5%.
Well, the Canadian economy has flatlined, and in fact, the U.S., the U.K., Germany, Australia, Sweden, the Netherlands, South Korea, even Spain are outpacing Canada in terms of GDP growth right now. Last quarter, the Canadian economy actually shrank, which would lead us to, we're halfway to a recession if there was another quarter of that. The fact is we do need to invest in a real plan for jobs and growth. Infrastructure is an excellent place to start, and helping build more livable communities and a more competitive economy while creating a lot of jobs for Canadians who need them. Youth unemployment is a real issue for a lot of middle-class families today. Young Canadians have lost 160,000 jobs than in 2008. We're really concerned about stagnant growth in jobs for all Canadians, but youth unemployment is a particular concern. There's a real risk of a lost generation. The time to invest is now. And the other thing to keep in mind is slow GDP growth and cuts in GDP projections actually mean less revenue for the government. Mm. And so I believe that the government is in deficit right now, and they should provide Canadians with a fiscal update so we understand where the hard ground is in terms of the government's fiscal situation. The budget's probably not balanced now.
Well, what do you make of that?
Well, look, the budget is balanced, and you know what won't help the Canadian economy is increased taxes like the NDP and the Liberals are proposing. I mean, the Liberals came out last week, the Liberal leader, and suggested that we hike CPP premiums on employees and employers across the country. That will lead to job cuts, by employers all across the country. That would actually lead to lower revenue for the government and put us into deficit. That's why we will not be doing that.
Let me ask you this. All economists are saying that wages aren't keeping pace with the standard of living in this country, and consumer spending is also lagging behind. The NDP, for example, and I'm not sure what the Liberals' position on this, but the NDP says the minimum wage should be increased to $15 an hour. Do you think that's acceptable?
We prefer a different route. We're focused on tax cuts, and that's why we have lowered taxes over 180 times. We're going to continue to lower taxes on every segment of society. And today, we have the lowest federal tax burden that we've had in over 50 years since John Diefenbaker was prime minister. We've lowered the GST. We're continuing low and freeze EI premiums. We're making sure the average family of four can continue to see lower taxes to the tune of $6,600. Lower taxes, put more money in the pockets of families, and that they can spend it how they wish.
Mr. Carroll.
Well, this is what I said when I mentioned that the government is not looking at the consequences of its actions. When you have an issue like income splitting, which will only basically give money back to the wealthiest of the 15% wealthiest households in the country, we know that this is not the best way to actually promote economic growth, because you have no insurance that that 15% will actually spend that money in the economy. When you have, for example, our proposal for a national daycare at a maximum of $15 a day, we know that this is a net contributor to economic growth. It has been demonstrated in Quebec. It has been confirmed by many economists. So this is why the government should actually stop looking at those measures as political measures, because these are pre-electoral measures, and looking really at contributing or helping the economy by measures that you can actually look and conclude that they are a net benefit for the economy.
Mr. Bryson.
Middle class families in Canada are tapped out. They're falling behind. They're actually struggling under record levels of personal debt right now, and they need a break. And that's why the Liberal plan would actually cut taxes for middle class Canadian families and provide a new Canada Child benefit, which would be bigger and fairer and simpler. Just to give you an example, Bob, for a family with two children making $90,000 per year, they will be $2,500 better off every year with the Liberal plan over what they're getting now from the Conservatives. For a family making $45,000 a year with
but
two
you're
kids,
all talking
they will be $4,000
better. What about jobs? People need jobs.
Well,
in
here's
this
the point. If you cut taxes on the rich, like the Conservatives are doing, that doesn't stimulate much growth. If you talk to the economists, cutting taxes on low-income and middle-income Canadians is much better for growth, because they're more likely to spend and generate growth within the economy. It's much more stimulative to cut taxes on the middle class and help low-income Canadians.
But what Liberals are doing is increasing payroll taxes, increasing those CPP premiums, increasing EI premiums on small business owners. They're the ones that drive the force of the economy. So you know it's basic economics. Scott knows this. When you increase those payroll taxes, you're going to hire less people. And you know who the first people who are going to be laid off if they put their plan in place? That will be young people, because they're the last ones in and the first ones out when employers can't make their payroll. What the Liberal plan will do.
I'm sorry, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. I have to cut it off. No. Thank you very much. Stimulating discussion. Greatly appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Boss. Thank
you very much.
Transit, housing, crumbling infrastructure. Municipalities are looking for money from the feds to help Canada's urban centres. And what better time to ask for cash than during an election year? Mayors from across the country have been meeting in Edmonton this weekend for their annual conference. And Vancouver's Gregor Robertson, chair of the Big City Mayor's Caucus, joins me from there now. Mayor Robertson, we have an election this fall. You've got two federal leaders at the meeting this weekend, but no Stephen Harper. Should the Prime Minister have been there as well?
Well, it sure be nice to have the Prime Minister here with all of the local governments from across Canada gathered together. I know he's certainly got a reasonable reason not to be here with the G8 meetings. And at the same time, Finance Minister Joe Oliver is here. It is great to see all of the parties showing up with significant players and putting significant attention on cities and communities across Canada, where the needs are great, but certainly most Canadians, 80% plus, live in cities. We want to be sure in this federal election that the parties are focused on cities and communities and are making very real commitments, very solid commitments to investing in our cities and communities.
What did the Federation ask the federal parties for in terms of infrastructure commitments? And I'm assuming there are a lot of votes to be lost over this issue if the parties don't pony up.
Yeah, we like to say that the path for the next federal government to form a majority is through Canada's cities. So we have we want to see a really robust platform from all the federal parties for cities and communities. And infrastructure is obviously key to that. Transit as a key component of infrastructure. And housing is a huge issue in our cities and communities across Canada. With infrastructure, we have a huge gap. We've fallen way behind cities around the world that we compete with in the global economy. And we want to make sure there are significant new investments being made by the parties and the next government of Canada after the election into our urban infrastructure. We have seen more attention on this, but at this point, the gap is huge. And we want to be sure, we don't have a specific number there, but we want to be sure that there are new tools. We're seeing commitments around more gas tax coming to cities. We're seeing some discussion about more funding from all of the parties. We're going to basically measure those off and make sure we track the commitments and make sure that all Canadians understand what each of the parties is putting forward and whether it comes close to meeting the needs in our cities. But at this point, we don't have all the solid commitments, but we will be tracking that as the weeks and months have progressed.
Well, Tom Mulcair is taking up what you've talked about in terms of increasing the gas tax for municipalities, also talking about a significant increase in core infrastructure spending. But isn't this the key here is that if you can get more money from the gas tax, you can do more for cities?
That's true. And, you know, the gas tax is a very useful tool that cities have to invest in infrastructure. And in Vancouver, we invest that directly in our public transit system. And if you look at the needs, whether it's transit or broader infrastructure needs across the country, I mean, Canadians are stuck in traffic jams at unbelievably brutal levels now. And so the transit investments have to happen. The roads and the bridges need to be upgraded. Those investments can flow from gas tax money. So that's a very useful way for the money to flow without a lot of conditions. We need flexibility and we need that money to move. So that's a very useful next step to hear from Mulcair and the NDP. Obviously, we want to see the bar continue to be raised. We look forward to seeing what commitments come from the other parties and make sure that that funding is flexible, that it moves directly to cities so that we can make a difference. We can reduce people's traffic congestion. We can make sure we're investing in the key infrastructure that keeps our jobs and our economy competitive.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission tabled its report last week in Ottawa. It was a very moving experience for reporters who were there to cover it. We know twice as many First Nations people live in poverty. They're 10 times more likely to be homeless in our urban cities. What needs to be done about this very serious problem?
Well, I think the Truth and Reconciliation Commission recommendations were very solid, very important to moving our country forward and to creating a whole new story for Aboriginal people, whether they're on reserve or in our cities. And that's a really important set of actions that the federal government and many other the other levels of government all need to pay attention to. Certainly as cities, our big city mayors are committed to taking action on the recommendations that have been put forward towards local governments. We want to be sure we're doing everything we can to support improved opportunities for urban Aboriginal people. And we're seeing, I think, really solid commitments from mayors across the country on this and great support for the work done by the Commission, by Reconciliation Canada. It's a very important time for our country to recognize and accept the horrific tragedies of the past and residential schools and the lack of opportunity for Aboriginal people in Canada and to transform that. And our cities can be very important players in doing that in partnership, obviously, with the federal government, provincial governments, territories. Everyone needs to step up and make sure those recommendations are put into action.
Mayor Robertson, thank you very much for joining us on Question Period.
Thank you very much. Take care, Robert.
We all know that the Senate is badly in need of reform. It has become a dysfunctional chamber and has fallen into disrepute.
That was former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney slamming the Senate even before the latest audit was leaked. We've assembled our scrum for the latest on the scandal. Joining us, Althea Raj from the Huffington Post, National Post columnist John Iveson, Tonda McCharles is back from the Toronto Star, and of course, Mr. Oliver. So, John, Mr. Mulroney is saying that what we need is two prominent Canadians, a Supreme Court judge, maybe a former auditor, to develop a code of conduct for the Senate, including, you know, housing and spending rules, but also to have the Prime Minister select future senators from a list provided by the provinces, because, he says, the place is completely dysfunctional.
Well, that, from what I gathered, talking to people like my esteemed colleague, Mr. Oliver, was what he proposed way back during the Charlton Accord, so no great surprise that that's... I'm not sure the public is going to accept any kind of reform right now. I think once this, all the details become known, the calls for abolition are going to ring from coast to coast, and the Conservative Party may find themselves pushed into a corner where they decide that they're going to campaign for abolition.
Well, and they said that today, Friday, actually.
And I think the provinces, Brad Wall in Saskatchewan was trying to mobilize provinces a year or so ago. There wasn't much of a feeling at that point. But since then, we've got an NDP government in Alberta. We've got a Federalist government in Quebec. And the Ontario government has been a little bit wishy-washy. McGuinty was in favour of abolition. So I think that there is a mood in the country where an abolition campaign might start to gather steam.
I think that what's happening now is people are furious, frustrated at the impotence of anyone to be able to come up with a solution or do anything about it. And the latest example is like the posse, as we used to say out west, joining the rustlers. Only this is worse because the posse was partly responsible for a lot of rustling itself, and they're the powers who the rustlers reported to. I mean, where do you go to straighten all this out?
But what are we going to do, though? I mean, you know, about this institution, because you've got nine more senators going to police investigation, 21 more with questionable expenses. I mean, people do want to know how this place is going to get fixed.
Don't look at me. I don't know what the solution is, but I can tell you, sitting at the Duffy trial, it's gobsmacking how the place is run, how little oversight there is on this stuff. You know, even the auditor, the woman who was directing audit and internal planning over there, admitted, you know, well, you know, we didn't conduct audits in a professional way. So on the one hand, you have, you know, do the senators themselves have a moral compass? And on the other hand, do they have a good check and balance within the institution? But really, sitting at the Duffy trial would, you know, it's enough to turn you into Craig Oliver, an abolitionist, right?
Althea, I mean, Mr. Tom Mulcair was on the show earlier, and he's saying that if he's elected, he's going to call the premiers together and see if he can get them moving, do some trading, but try to get this place abolished. The Liberal leader is saying he just wants to basically take Mr. Mulroney's suggestion, which is select better people for the place. But at some point, something better has to happen than this patronage den where everybody seems to be able to spend money without any real questions.
Well, it's not just the Senate. I mean, I think if the MPs themselves were being held to the same standards as the senators, there'd be much more than 970.
Well, they're at least elected. We've got to give them
that. Yeah, they are elected, but that the openness and the transparency that even we're starting to see on the Senate side does not exist on the House side. And MPs have refused. When Elizabeth May tried to bring a motion forward last spring in 2014, she was shut down by Conservative MPs. They're not the only party who don't actually want an audit of MPs.
Well, but you can be sure that after what happened in the Senate, that there will be no MPs inviting a forensic audit into that place.
No, absolutely not. But when it comes to a solution for the Senate, I just don't see a situation where abolition really happens. And what we saw on Friday was Poilievre stands up and says, well, if we can get all the provinces to agree and they come to us with that solution, we'll support it. And that's probably the only option.
Well,
I can't see PEI agreeing to abolition.
Well, but no, but it's, if I think I'm right in saying the Supreme Court said it was a 750. It wasn't.
No, abolition is unanimous.
Abolishment is unanimous.
Abolition takes unanimous consent of all the provinces, territories, and the federal government, and by the way, a vote in both the House and the Senate themselves.
Yeah.
So it's all but impossible, really. But
if the mood of the country is such that this thing is beyond the pale,
yes,
then no politician, even unelected politicians, can afford to ignore the will of the people.
It would take, as I see it, I mean, even if anyone were to move that way in a serious manner, or any political party, it would take such serious horse trading, the likes of which, you're right, Mulroney tried in Charlottetown.
And that's what really dragged him down.
But also Charlottetown was, you know, let's solve everything at once, all the you know, Supreme Court problems and this and that, whatever the problem was, it was all in that little kettle of fish, right? But
If there was a solid, you know, well, what's it going to take for us to get Newfoundland to give up six seats? Well, you know, or PEI to give up their four, or whoever.
Or Quebec to give up the numbers it's always guaranteed there. It is a stopper for Quebec. It's very important.
Yes, but is it going to take, you know, I mean, it already costs us, what, 90 to 100 million a year in operating? I mean, 10 years, it's $1 billion. You know, maybe it takes $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion. What's it going to take?
And all of us who lived through the constitutional battles this really almost, it fragmented the country. And I mean, there is the risk of that when you reopen the Constitution, because Quebec will say, well, we need to solve our distinct society stuff before we're going to agree to any kind of Senate reform.
I used to like the idea of smothering the Senate, which is you just stop appointing anybody until the last person dies at 98 and it's
like
the end
now
of the Senate.
Which is what Harper's doing.
Mr. Harper has got 22 seats to fill. What is the next prime minister going to do? What decisions will he make about how those filling those seats?
But constitutionally, that doesn't work either. Constitutionally,
they would be ordered by the courts probably to fill those jobs. But I wonder if Mr. Harper, I hope this wouldn't happen, while he's still prime minister, if he was defeated before he gives up his government, would he use those 22 seats to appoint a bunch of Tories? Because he knows if he doesn't, the Liberals or the NDP or some the next guy might do it.
Most immediately, what are the strategies going to be going into the election? Because I don't think the three parties can stick to their current strategy. Obviously, the NDP can, but I think the Liberal one looks a little bit dubious if public opinion is completely inflamed after next Tuesday. I think the Conservatives are already signaling they're going to start moving.
Well, Althea, we know why Mr. Trudeau a year ago decided to get rid of the Liberal senators, because most of them seem to be Liberals.
Yeah, it does seem pretty wise at the time. I just want to make a point. I don't think, I mean, obviously I haven't seen the Senate report. If it's actually $576,000 shared between five senators,
it is.
You know, that's pretty bad. But do we really want to get rid of another chamber because of the deeds of so few? And we're not talking about a majority of senators who've actually gotten caught with misdeeds.
28% of the 105 that were reviewed.
Yes,
high.
And some of those expenses are $3,000 for a trip. And as far as I understand it, some of those expenses do sound like they were parliamentary business, for the same reason as Pamela Wallin, a bunch of her expenses, her travel claims, actually did sound like legit parliamentary business. Mm-hmm. That you're going to the NAC for some Saskatchewan-related thing, that's not private business. You're a senator from Saskatchewan. And so I don't know that really we should be encouraging the public to lynch the members of the upper chamber
There were plenty of calls for abolition long before this expenses scandal, based on what's
and
it good
for. And they have not done themselves any favors. The story about Senator Cahignan and Senator Cowan and the Speaker, Housakis, getting involved in essentially setting up a different arbitration system for themselves, that's outrageous. They are themselves digging themselves into a hole.
They're
own worst enemy at the moment. And I know a number of senators on both sides of the chamber who just want to bang their head against the desk because their leadership is completely out to lunch.
Right, and that's where I was going to go. What's playing out in the larger picture, very much also, you know, there's an interplay between what's going on at the courthouse where Mike Duffy's on trial now and the legal findings that will be there. It'll play into whatever gets done with all these other cases. But I'm not sure the Senate leadership itself has figured out just how big a problem this is for themselves. If, just as Althea said, you know, three of the top leaders in the Senate have found themselves caught up in it and then think the way to do it is to set up some sort of little side process to resolve their problems. So they don't get it.
The most popular idea seems to be somehow a House of Distinguished Canadians, but that might make it worse because it would then give a respectability and moral power to the Senate. Which is still unelected in that circumstance.
Well, in fairness, Pamela Wallin and Mike Duffy were well-regarded Canadians. Nobody expected that they would land in the kind of trouble that they did. But speaking of Mr. Duffy, he's got to be smiling at this audit report in some way because part of his defense has been, hey, I ain't the only one. They're all doing it.
No question. And on Friday, you know, at the courthouse,
every bank robber could say that. I mean, it's true. That doesn't help. If you know it's wrong, the fact that all kinds of other people are also doing wrong doesn't make you any easier to get nailed.
No, but I think there's a certain schadenfreude, shall we say, mm-hmm. going on in his over on the defense side of the courtroom last Friday after all that news broke.
Okay, on that we have to wrap. Thanks, everybody. We'll can't wait until Tuesday's Auditor General's report.
There are less than 3 weeks left in the sitting, but this week will be an especially busy one for Canadian politics. The Duffy trial, of course, continues in Ottawa. Stephen Harper travels from Germany to Poland tomorrow, where he'll meet with the president and prime minister. Then he heads to the Vatican to see Pope Francis. And back here in Canada, the Auditor General's long-awaited report on Senate expenses will be made public on Tuesday. Last week, the RCMP musical ride paid tribute to the Mounties killed in last year's shooting rampage in Moncton. We'll leave you with that. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.